So I'm not going to say anything new today. Most of this is in the everything I'm going to say is in the letter is essentially in the literature, but I think it I think there's some things there that not everyone is entirely aware of, so it's worth discussing. The basic question I want to address is the quantum to classical transition in inflation. I'll just start by way of some intro, and then I will discuss two different features that any system generally needs to be classical. One is classicality in the WKB sense, and the other is decoherence. Okay. And I'm not going to, actually, for most of the talk, I'm not going to talk in great deal about inflation. I just want to bring up the issue in the introduction and then talk about these kinds of classicality. Okay. So, first, by way of background, the one of the major successes of inflation, as everyone must know by now, especially after months of this workshop, is that inflation produces adiabatic scale invariant Gaussian fluctuations from quantum effects which lead to the structural formation that we see on the sky. So the interesting thing about the interesting thing about this scenario is that the eventual classical large-scale structure that we see comes from initial highly quantum mechanical fluctuations. So the scenario I have in mind is, imagine I have some scalar field, which is the inflaton, and then V of phi is the potential, and you all must know the story by now. So I can imagine, for example, some chaotic inflation scenario where the homogeneous mode of the scalar field is slowly rolling down the hill, slowly enough so that the change in that I can approximate the metric by some approximate de Sitter form where this is the metric on flat 3 space. I'm choosing a particular slicing, and h squared is v over 3. And Planck squared up to various factors of 2 pi. So this is the usual scenario, and as long as the roll is sufficiently slow so that h is not changing much on the order of the time defined by h, then you have typical slow roll inflation. And as the story goes, it's small fluctuations of this quantum fluctuations of the scalar field around this vacuum expectation value lead to fluctuations in the potential, which one can think of then as producing fluctuations in the metric itself. And those fluctuations in the metric itself at the end of inflation imprint itself in various ways on fluctuations in the density and temperature of the universe at the end of inflation. So the point is that when I do this calculation, this delta phi is to be understood as a quantum effect that I compute like so. And typically, one takes the size of this fluctuation in the actual calculation. One takes the size of this fluctuation to be, one takes this expectation value for a given momentum mode at the point where the physical momentum is of order the Hubble scale. So the point I want to make here is that I'm starting with a quantum mechanical calculation. I just compute this using quantum field theory. And what I get at the end of the day is the classical universe that we see, all the galaxies that we see, and so forth. All of that structure, all the lumps, are produced by these initial quantum fluctuations. So at some point, there was a transition from this highly quantum mechanical behavior of the scalar field to the highly classical structure that we see. So that I claim, is in itself interesting, but one place where you really have to start thinking about it is in eternal inflation. If you want to take eternal inflation seriously, which is already a very confusing question. And in eternal inflation, the point is that when this scalar field fluctuates uphill, the claim is that in the regions where the scalar field has gotten slightly larger, overall, you're higher on the hill, and it will take you longer to roll down. So although the fluctuations, although when I compute these fluctuations, they can just as well go forward or back, the claim is that very quickly, the fluctuations which go in this direction dominate the universe, because it takes longer for inflation to the end. The universe has longer to inflate, and so if I take some appropriate space flight slice, I'm dominated by regions of the universe where I've fluctuated uphill. So phi uphill, more inflation. So there are a lot of questions that this set of arguments poses. One is, can this argument be made precise in the sense that, among other things, there's this choice of weighting that goes into the claim that things that fluctuate uphill eventually dominate. And talking about this at all, you need to make things much more precise than I've just done, and it's not entirely clear how to do that. Related is this, does this make any sense? And I mean this in the sense that most, in eternal inflation, most of the universe, and in particular, the parts of the universe that are causing you to claim that the universe is dominated by regions which inflate for a long time, most of this universe is out of reach of any one observer. So this should already just cause you to worry in general, because it's not something you really would ever have access to. But more specifically, you might draw a lesson, and I'm going to put this in question marks, from studies of black hole complementarity, that regions of the universe which are completely out of causal contact from you are not to be thought of in some sense as physically separate, but merely as other ways of coding information that is available to you. So the lesson, the statement of black hole complementarity is that I can, in black hole complementarity, is I can describe physics from the point of view of an outside observer, or I can describe physics from the an observer sitting outside the black hole and watches the black hole evaporate, or I can describe physics from the point of view of an observer falling into the black hole. And those don't really describe two separate things, rather they are the physics in one frame is encoded in a very complicated way in terms of the other frame.
I'm not sure I get the sum. Are you saying that only if you have something like black hole complementarity does eternal inflation make sense?
No, I'm saying the lesson from black hole complementarity is that I don't really know how to think about internal inflation in some sense, because it's not clear that I should think of this patch and together with another patch that's out of causal contact with me. The claim of black hole complement, if I make a direct analogy with black hole complementarity, I would not do that. I would not think of them as separate regions from the point of view of the full quantum theory.
But what are black hole complementarity? Can't we just think of it completely classically?
No. I think the most disturbing thing from the point of view of black hole complementarity is black hole complementarity tells you that the idea that you count separately as independent commuting degrees of freedom, things that are on
each side of the
sides of an event horizon. It says there's at least one case where that seems not to work. Now, in eternal inflation, everything that you do, and in particular this volume weighting of different regions of the universe, depends precisely on saying that you use the field theory counting of degrees of freedom over this vast space, most pieces of which are cosmically disconnected from each other. And so those two ideas seem to have some tension between them. It's not clear that there's complete conflict between
It's not clear there's conflict. It's not clear how you think about complementarity in cosmological situations and so on and so forth. So that's why I just take this lesson with a question mark. But it's something to keep in mind. The statement is that in some sense, this argument about eternal inflation is really a classical. Making use of classical physics very quickly. Once things fluctuate uphill, I assume that this means that this back reacts on the classical metric, on the classical spacetime, and things inflate for longer. So this issue of when I start thinking about things as classical really comes to the fore. Okay. So I just wanted to say all this by way of introduction. I'm not going to answer any of these questions. I just think that this really these issues really force you to think, if you want to understand things in depth, to really think about how these quantum fluctuations eventually become classical and in what sense they become classical. So for the rest of this talk, I'm just going to mention two different standard measures of classicality in the usual WKB sense, and decoherence, and how those might appear during inflation. Okay. So the first. The first kind of classicality is something that you presumably learn in undergraduate quantum mechanics. And the basic point is that there exist states and operators, some particular nice set of states and operators, such that expectation values of operators essentially factorize. Like so. So what this means essentially is if there is some complicated operator algebra, it essentially doesn't matter for these states. And this actually was made very nice and precise in a review, partly original work by Yaffe in Valeri Yaffe in Reviews of Modern Physics from the 80s. The point is that if in some sense you can take h bar small, you have to be careful with that since h bar is dimensionful, or in many large M theories, you can define a nice set of states and operators such that this factorization limit holds. And as a partial example, let me take some nice smoothly varying potential as a function of x. And then I have some wave function which varies over distance scales, which is much smaller than the distance scale set by the second derivative of this potential. So in particular, let me let V triple prime, if the width of this is sigma squared over V prime, if this is true, I can then use then Ehrenfest's theorem essentially gives you the classical equations of motion in the usual way. So in particular, this is a true fact. this just follows from Ehrenfest's theorem, but under these conditions, then this factorizes nicely into minus u prime fx. So that's classicality in the old WKP sense, that these fluctuations in position don't matter very much. Okay, but this, and more generally, this isn't quite enough if you want to think of things in terms of both position and momentum. In general, we also might want, say, x squared p squared, you have order x squared p squared, like so. And for this to be true, for this piece of this correlation function to dominate, then this is going to have to be much greater than h bar squared. So as long as the product of these fluctuations is greater than h bar squared, then this factorized piece dominates over the pieces that you get from the commutation relations of x and p. And so, but what this does mean is that the fluctuations here, both in x and p, have to be fairly large. So you get these kinds of states in what are called squeeze states.
Can I point to point one now, right? The expectation of x squared is left bracket x, right bracket square.
Yeah, is the right-hand side of this the connected expectation value?
Yes, so far it is, yeah.
It's the connected one,
right. This already has to be true, which means this has to be fairly large.
So if
x and p is fairly large, yes, that's also true.
But your right. expectation of x squared has a piece which is expectation of x quantity
right.
squared.
Right. If you can get, yes. So, yes, it has this piece in general. That's
but
right.
it's not enough for that piece to be bigger than h bar. Is it not? Why not? Because x or is just too big.
X squared, I also need this, has to be greater than x. X squared has to be approximately equal to this, and then p squared has to be approximately equal to p squared for all this to work out.
Will that contradict point one?
No. Because you've assumed in the first writing, I think, that the expectation value of x and p were essentially zero. So that you're talking about the fluctuations,
right.
No?
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that the variance is of order of the mean square.
X could just, X is not, it's not a translation during the statement.
Yes. I should think of this as in terms of x minus. Thank you. I should be writing x minus x.
Okay, perfect.
Thank you.
Although that's discussed with phi, there is a meaning to the position.
Right. In terms of quantum mechanics, let me just talk about things in terms of this. So then the fluctuations of x may be small. I have to worry at this level.
Okay, but on the left side of the board, mm-hmm. your equation that your hand is very close to there.
Yes.
That equation is no longer true on the right side of the board.
Not if a and b are just x and p. So they have to be x squared and p squared.
That's what I was confused about.
So you're now the point, yeah.
This equation when you're doing this side.
The point is going to be that for a simple free particle, it's going to be hard to get that for just x and p. Let me just continue and write down an explicit example where you get this, because this example is what actually shows up in inflation.
But that's not the only way that you can get the squeeze state.
No. So let me just mention a particular example, which is the following upside down harmonic oscillator. Okay, so I'm going to write down the following ansatz for the wave. And what, in particular, this was worked out by Guth and P. And they solved this equation. In particular, they argued that for large time, assuming for large time, I can write this as 2 over half. Plus I phi moment and let me just define these constants here. K squared is h bar over root m k, and I can write, I define this with some initial condition at t equals 0, and that defines phi, like so. So this is the wave function at large time. And in particular, let me just write down some expectation values for you. So x, this is getting very large at large times. But it's also true that xp psi, okay, x squared psi, px psi is the same minus I h bar, and then plus a decaying piece here. So as long as root mk x squared is much larger than h bar, like so, or which means that x squared is much greater than a squared, then I can essentially ignore this piece here, and x and p essentially factorize. So in this sense, this upside down simple harmonic oscillator becomes classical at late times, in the sense that x and p and their fluctuations get sufficiently large that the uncertainty term can be ignored.
This would not work just for x, because it's half on the left and half on the right.
Yeah, and the fluctuations in x are get quite large.
So it's classical, even though it's...
Well, let me just write down a sort of measure of the probability distribution. And what you'll see is the statement is it's classical in the sense that x and p are tightly correlated, if I look at the probability distribution. But it's, I should think of x now as a stochastic variable with some width. And that's indeed, I mean, this is just going to be a mode of the inflaton. So the point is that in the inflaton, I get some, each mode of the inflaton is some stochastic invariable with some probability distribution. And this is how you get that. Let me, so as long as this is true, the statement is that this is in some sense classical in the sense that x and p are tightly correlated. Let me just write down a measure of this. It's a measure you have to be a little careful, is to look at the Wigner function corresponding to this wave function. And the Wigner function, in some sense, defines a probability measure on phase space. So the definition is the following. And I say in some sense because it's not positive definite, so it's problematic. But I can look at phi q minus x over 2 t psi q plus x over 2 t, there's a star here, and then e times e to the minus ixt. Okay, so I can write down this function here, and Guth and P managed to argue that f goes to psi xt delta p minus p classical. Like so. Just to mention the sense in which you can sort of think of this as a probability distribution, the fact is that
squared.
Thank you. Dx dq f of q p t is psi twiddle n dp, setting as psi q. So again, you have to be careful with thinking of this as a probability measure. As David said, it's not positive definite, but it does solve Liouville's equation in this limit, at least. And the point is that, right. Thank you. But the main point I want to make is that this, although this is going, may well be highly spread out in X, it's tightly, strongly peaked in along the classical trajectories. So I can think of it as classical in this sense, but it's still strongly quantum in that the wave function in X and T is spread out, and to find some probability distribution.
Do you think it's classical just because interference is much smaller than?
It's not obvious an interference is small. If I just look.
Do you know the strength of interference?
No, not with
it. I think my impression is that if it's smaller, then you can say if interference is small, you can say that it's classical.
Doesn't it follow from this that you can rewrite all of the expectation values of arbitrary powers of
right.
X and P
right.
to the extent these approximations right. are correct? In terms of a stochastic process.
Yes.
A purely classical
that's right.
equations.
That's right.
A necessary condition for that is that interference is small.
Yeah. Yeah, so I would have said that in that sense.
Yes. Yes, in that sense, yes. Okay, let me just tie this to inflation. So inflation, if I have some scalar field, phi, I can write down the following variable here, and essentially, if I choose some particular co-moving momentum at k plus k squared minus y is equal to zero. So the story is that when k when this, when k squared, when the physical momentum becomes, when the physical momentum becomes less than h, this essentially, this essentially becomes an upside down harmonic oscillator equation, and the same arguments apply. So if we assume initially that the state is in some standard for when the physical momentum is larger than the Hubble scale, this essentially acts as a positive mass term. I can assume that this mode is in its ground state, which is the usual assumption that I'm in the Bunch-Davies vacuum. And then once the mode redshifts so that this is true, then the effective mass becomes negative, and I evolve to the situation I've been discussing here.
Mm-hmm. Well, this earlier criterion. So one way of saying it is that these oscillatory terms that take that negative have to be small, so to speak. Right? Make the Wigner function negative.
Yeah, the...
Those are effectively small.
Yeah, that's right.
They're small as compared to everything else.
That's right. Yeah. But I think the Vicker function actually oscillates pretty wildly.
Is there also a sharp connection to decoherence with this criterion that you're going to make, or not?
No. In general, my understanding, and maybe, and Jim can correct me here, my understanding is the relation between decoherence and classicality in this sense is not actually tight, completely tight.
Is not what?
Is not tight.
So to be classical, you need both or only?
I would say you need both to be classical in the usual sense.
Can you define some kind of semi-classical stress energy tensor for the scalar field with large fluctuations coupled with the semi-classical gravity?
Well, that's going to be part of the question. I think certainly once I can say that this is really a classical state, then yes, I can do that. When the thing is fluctuating strongly, you might conceptually worry about what it means. If the fluctuations in the stress tensor were large, then that equation is worrisome. Okay, so let me just mention the second requirement. So in general, this for the wave function to be classical in the usual sense, this isn't quite enough. And that I can certainly write down a WKB wave function which is like this. But nothing stops me from, say, with an approximation like this, writing down a wave function psi, which is just, say, psi q1 of x, psi q2 of x, which might be, look something like this. So these can be extremely heavy macroscopic particles. These could be good WKB wave functions for these particles. But nothing stops me initially from writing down macroscopic superpositions like this, and which nonetheless we don't observe in nature. This is essentially the Schrodinger's cat problem, that one tries to start imagining cats which are both in a superposition of alive or dead, or a superposition of a cat over here and a cat over here. And this is, but on the other hand, this isn't something we ever see in nature. What we see is, what we see are, for example, cats sitting at one place, a cat either alive or dead, and evolving forward according to classical equations of motion. So if I just took the some single very, very heavy particle by itself, nothing stops this from happening, and I'm going to get interference between these two terms. The claim, on the other hand, it's not true. A cat is a fairly complicated object, and furthermore, it interacts with its environment. And that interaction is going to change the story. Essentially, it's going to remove the nice superposition property like this. So let me say more generally what I mean is I can imagine, say, this being the position eigenstate of some relatively heavy particle, like a dust particle. And I can imagine this dust particle moving around in a bath of photons. So initially, before the photons start interacting, it would be in this state. But over time, as these particles scatter off the dust particle, this will evolve into, say, after one scattering event, into something that looks like this. There are assumptions I'm making that go into this equation, that recoil is small. In particular, the recoil is small. And that the interaction is a simple function of x. So what can happen then is, as time goes on, if I have some superposition x psi plus x prime psi, these two pieces of the wave function will evolve differently. X s of x psi plus x prime. And if these evolve for a long enough time, and generally if the system is sufficiently complicated, then this piece will have very little overlap with this piece. In particular, if I write down a density matrix for the dust particle and its position basis, that density matrix will become diagonal. So let me just outline a calculation by Jusen Zay, which shows exactly that.
You're not actually removing one of the humps, so the other is just an interference term you're going away.
Yes, that's right.
You're observing.
Yeah, well, in some sense, in this case, the photons themselves are what's carrying out the observation.
But you're still confused as to why you get one hump or the other.
That's right. This psi would actually include the bath of photons and you and any other observers, and you would have an observer which sees one place, an observer which sees another place, and which branch you're in is essentially stochastic.
Yeah, but you have to ask yourself how you set up that initial superposition,
yes,
of this macroscopic thing in two different places.
But sure, very
what, because this decoherent process is happening all the time.
Yes. Time. It's extremely fast. And so you can, in very special situations, get something like some sort of macroscopic. In very special cases, if you prepare things very carefully, you can get these macroscopic superpositions. And then there is always a decoherence time. And if you're lucky, you can design situations where the decoherence time is longer than the time scale of your experiment. But you really have to work. So this is in particular a problem for quantum computers. I think this is like the main. So if I look at a situation like this, I imagine that this evolves forward in time, like so. The density matrix for the dust particle after this time is just going to be rho is going to evolve from the initial density matrix, which is fairly simple, times psi s dagger x prime s x psi. So I imagine for the initial density matrix, if I start in this nice pure state, I write down the full wave function psi total d3x 5x x psi like so, then rho of x x prime so I start with this density matrix characteristic of a pure state, and over time the question is going to be what happens to this density matrix, and in particular what happens to the off diagonal components, which measure the degree to which I have a nice simple superposition like this with all the interference terms intact.
This is in what context? They were able to prove, somebody was able to prove that you have
that. So I'm going to give you sketch out a calculation under a certain set of assumptions in which this decoherence will occur.
This is for a scalar field?
No, phi, x is the position of some dust, phi is just a wave function. X is some dust particle, the position eigenstate of some dust particle. And then psi is just the state of some bath of photons. And I'm going to imagine that this happens each time a single photon scatters off of the dust particle, and calculate this matrix element, and then ask what happens in the bath. So I'm going to assume that in the scattering process there's no recoil, which means that this position x doesn't change. I'm going to assume a translation invariance so that if I write this down in terms of k, where k is the momentum of the photon, and I'm finally going to assume that the initial momentum wave function is a delta function around k naught, some volume factor like so, and that k naught x minus x prime. So I'm going to assume for the moment that the wavelength of the light is larger than the separation. Once the wavelength of the light is smaller than the separation, I think the situation is even better. It's just an approximation to make the calculation easy.
Okay.
you're interacting here with a whole gas of photons.
That's right. So I'm just going to do one. I'm doing.
This is a one particle.
This is a one particle state. So what I'm going to assume is this is what happens after one scattering process, and then in the end you ask what happens over time when I have some flux of photons passing the dust particle. So finally, I'm going to let S thank you. So a translation invariant just means that this X appears as a phase out front, as a func, and then this is just scattering off of something at the origin with the initial and final momenta. And I'm going to assume, finally, I'm just going to write the scattering matrix finally as delta 3 k minus k prime, and then 2 pi k f k. And although this scattering is not going to conserve spatial momentum, I'm going to assume it conserves energy of the photon. And I can plug this into here. I have to be a little careful because I get squares of delta functions. So I'm just going to assume that delta k minus k prime squared is the size of the system times delta k minus k prime, like so. And I'm also going to use the optical theorem. Which I need for unitarity. And the result at the end of the day is that psi s dagger x prime sx psi 1 over 4 0 k prime squared over so this is the final answer. And for sufficiently small x prime and x, I can expand this out in powers of the argument. And in particular, at the end of the day, I'm going to keep the quadratic term is going to survive because of the angular integrations. And what I'll find then is that rho goes as 1 where this effective cross section is an integral over is related to an integral over f squared.
That's where you use the optical.
The optical theorem went in at this stage. It comes from dealing with the. You need to do it to deal with these cross terms here. So I get when I take s squared, I get a cross term here and here, which is linear in f. At that point, I use the optical theorem. So let me write this down explicitly. I can, if I write down the prime here, this is related to an integral over F. So finally, let me just, at the end of the day, rho, therefore, is going to, after one time step, is going to go like k0 squared delta x squared sigma squared over 8 pi squared L squared. And after n scattering, I claim that it's just going to go as n times. After n scattering events, it's just going to keep decreasing like this. And so now I just say n is roughly the system size times the flux times time, L squared dt. And I say at the end that rho goes as e to the minus gamma x minus x prime squared of t, where this this is a localization rate in 1 over length squared times time. 1 over length squared, 1 over time.
So is this the same as this famous calculation that gives 10 to the minus 23 seconds for a kilogram of mass interacting with the
whiteboard vector? Yeah, I'm going to write down those numbers in like 2 seconds, or some numbers in 2 seconds. So where here m is k0 squared sigma effective over 8 pi squared times n over v. V, of course, v is just going to be c for light particles. So just since I then did, you can do this calculation either in the limit of Rayleigh scattering where the wavelength is larger than the object, or in the geometric limit. In the limit of Rayleigh scattering, this goes as, I now assume that I have a bath of photons at some temperature, and I average over all the momentum modes, and I get essentially that this goes as kT over c to the ninth times c to the sixth. And similarly, in the geometric optics limit where the wavelength is smaller than the size of the dust particle, this goes as a squared c, which just scales as a squared, and then has kT over c. Okay, so let me show you just how efficient this can be, and then we'll close. So imagine that I have dust at a is 10 to the minus 3 centimeters, or 10 to the minus 5 centimeters, or a small molecule at 10 to the minus 6 centimeters. And I'm going to write lambda in units of 1 over centimeter squared times time. And if I look at CMB photons, for sufficiently large dust particles, the CMB photons already do pretty well. But at 300, if I just look at the photons that I get from room temperature, this number gets absolutely huge, and so forth. So if you just take these numbers here and plug in a nice separation of order a millimeter or a centimeter, you find the localization time is fantastically fast. So that's all I wanted to say, that in once you add any sort of reasonable interaction with the environment, then even though I had some state which was initially a superposition of different possible, say, different positions, a Holle quantum superposition of different positions, very quickly interaction with the environment decoheres all those possible initial position eigenstates. So a combination of this decoherence with and a quasi-classical state really gives you something you can really honestly call a classical trajectory. A classical trajectory for the system. So this is all I was going to say, is the things I think I basically understand. Now, in inflation, we've actually been arguing about this. I've been talking to various people about this. And you can now ask the question, at what point does this happen during inflation? Among other, for starters, just when you When you look at any actual scenario, there are a large number of quantum fields lying around, the electromagnetic field and so on and so forth. And the quantum fields themselves will respond to the local geometries. Essentially, they'll see the local curvature, if you like, if you drew some. And that might actually be enough to do it, although I don't think a sharp calculation has ever been done, which is well-defined. Certainly by reheating it, it's going to happen. But I think reheating.
Fields are not highly excited during
reheating. No, you just have to have enough degrees of freedom, to soak up the phase information.
In some sense, couldn't you get that from just the fluctuation? Well, the quanta of the scalar field as well as the gravitons, or is there some sense in which that? There is a little degree of freedom system.
Well, the quanta.
Separates those degrees of freedom from, say,
that might, if I just include the background gravitons, that actually might be enough.
Well, I've never done any calculations, but right. I have people who have done these calculations and trying to have a quasi-classical space-time emerge
right.
from some quantum
right.
fields and quantum gravitational fields. Presumably, they're just talking about gravitons in that case.
They're just talking about gravitons. I don't understand those. I don't understand those calculations. So that's why I'm not talking about them, and I'm not sure that the issue is. It's by no means clear to me that the issue is shut.
There are a lot of WKB sense.
Right.
There's a good argument.
In the first WKB sense, is yeah.
They can be called as classical.
That's right. So in that sense, I think that's well established in any reasonable inflation scenario. But
you said that we need both of these things to be true.
Yes. That's right. And so it's a decoherence that. That is still somewhat open. I mean, I think there are people that think they know, but no, neither I nor anyone I talk to understands this paper.
Well, the argument that I've heard,
right.
I heard this first from this one, Seskind and Rodrad, even though never actually appeared in this paper recently. If you imagine doing, a test calculation, so you have the scalar field, so its state is a superposition of different classical configurations. You imagine that that's going to decohere. Now we're going to test and see what. So you put that in, you stick it into Einstein's equations, the geometry changes. Now
you're using semi-classical gravity here, right?
I'm using this idea that the distribution of the scalar field looks like that of a stochastic classical variable. So let me do gravity as if it was a stochastic classical variable. I'm going to take one particular realization of the probability distribution, look at what happens. I get some different geometry. Now you take quantum field theory, which I think Steve is right, it's enough to take the quantum field theory of gravitons on that background.
Right.
You think about that in some fixed coordinate
right.
system. So it's a fixed coordinate system, quantum field theory, with some different background classical fields.
Right.
All right. And now you calculate, the ground state, or any reasonable state of the quantum field in that background in Kuskla. In coordinate volumes, the geometry, the background fields, differ over relatively large volumes. The states have overlaps with each other. They go like exponential minus those volumes. And so once those volumes over which the geometry differs are macroscopically large in coordinate in that particular coordinate system, then you've got states that look like they decohere from each other.
And this is
this is just ordinary inflation.
That's right.
This is, it's not using the fluctuations to do, to say something about the global structure. We're just talking about what's going to be in the causal patch seen by an observer after inflation. So none of these issues about what happens on the other side of our horizon comes into this calculation.
Right.
All right, it's all quantum field theory in the causal
function. Coming back to the decoherence part of the thing, it's not actually quite true that that's perfectly okay. We thought it was. It is true that long after the wavelength clears the horizon, we have perfect equilibrium. And
so that is true.
Yeah.
Because of what's under that, or
no? Just it's a standard calculation. I had paper on side.
Yeah, I mentioned. I meant to mention your paper and Sasaki's as well.
Right. The same thing. But the point that we all forgot was that there are wavelengths that leave the horizon just a little bit before the end of inflation. And of course, there are also wavelengths that never leave the horizon. So there must be some sort of a transition between classicality and not classicality. And those wavelengths, of course, now are perfectly macroscopic. So, you know, in fact, it's the only case that I know where we can't solve this sweep the Schrodinger's cat problem under the roof. For those scales, there really is a problem. But what's going on?
Same with the scales that never leave, is that right?
No, the scales that only just leave. They don't have a
roof. They're sort of in the intermediate regime. I'm confused, though. I mean, the calculation of Ewan and Guth and P don't talk about decoherence in the sense of the last part of my talk.
No, that's right.
You say that those aren't even WKB, that's what you're worrying about.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Are those scales that we can actually observe?
Those are usually. Those are of order the Hubble size at the very end of inflation.
One application of that is that in some cases you can form black holes at the end of inflation whose size is the horizon size.
Uh-huh.
And these could have observable effects. Bernard Carr is the biggest one on that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the black holes may be out there, but they sort of don't know if they're there or not.
Okay.
Surely the cap problem really is there for those black holes.
But the CMB
is
interacting with those guys long since.
But we haven't even solved the WKB part of it. It's not even classically the WKB sense.
Right.
But if I was talking about fluctuations that are galaxy size,
then the WKB part is fine.
What is the. Oh, go ahead.
No. Let's see, I think your calculation here might suggest that during inflation we might have decoherence four modes leave the horizon. Is that fair? And if so, might that screw up the scale invariant spectrum perturbation?
Off the top of my head, I don't know, but I don't.
Until you have classical variables.
Well, you can have you can couple a spin half system to an environment and get decoherence in that sense. You know, so some two state system and the system will relax to some ground state. It's not a classical variable at all. But I don't think in this case that you'll get that. I think. That's why I say that the relation isn't always tight.
What happens to in this calculation that you did? There was this no recoil assumption.
Yes, that's right. So generally, what you need is that's right. That's right.
Because the WKB approximation was good.
That's right. That's right. In this calculation, I don't see that in this calculation you're going to get anywhere until this is a fairly large amplitude. The amplitude of the fluctuation is fairly large. And is not going to be affected by anything else. But in general, the relationship is not tight in the sense that I can have decoherence without classical.
Why do you need a classical variable to break in? It's certainly this calculation would, but more generally.
You have to be able to have, for this environmental decoherence story, you have to be able to have variables of the system that's interacting
right.
with the environment that are changed in all of these
that's
interactions.
Right.
Okay. And this may not be the only way to do it, but sort of the canonical way to do that is to have a big classical variable which you can't change very much by a little microscopic scattering. So you can mess up phases.
Right.
But you can't mess up
right, the right, right, exactly.
The magnetization of a magnet is pointing
good. So you're saying that whereas this is focusing on the position variable, you're saying the real issue would be just find those variables which are not.
That's right.
That's right.
This is essentially, you know, the statement that I have to choose a nice set of classical variables. I have to choose a coarse graining which, where those are specified within some accuracy. And that coarse graining has to be good in the sense that they're not going to be changed, you know, that I can really specify them to some degree. And that general quasi-classicality allows me to do that. It is true that I can design systems, simple quantum systems, which you wouldn't think of quasi-classical in this sense, which do due to decoherence. And there's a whole, it's really important when you talk about quantum computers, things like that. So you have to be a little careful.
Even if you have a reduce the problem to a classical or stochastic distribution, where is the ensemble of universes over which the averaging takes place? That is, when does our universe have its parameters fixed?
Well, that's in some sense part of the story, right? I mean, I get this distribution of fluctuations. This distribution is in the distribution of fluctuations of the gravitational fields encoded in the wave function. Now, to say that there's no interference term between this, I need to assume that there's a lot more than just those fluctuations, or there's enough more than those fluctuations that that I can remove all the, by essentially tracing them out, I can remove all the interference terms.
No, you still have an ensemble.
You're asking a philosophical question.
Yes.
It's an experience.
This,
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, you
are. I think it really is. I think the question is, you know, what is quantum mechanics reality, or is it a machine for predicting what we can see about reality? So if you just think about it in the second way, then what this thing predicts is that we don't know what the answer is for the universe, but there is some probability that it's going to look like this and some probability that it's going to look like that. And if we look out and we see that what we see looks like a typical number of that probability distribution, we say we won.
Right. Okay. Now,
it's very limited.
Right. I mean, it's true that there is some imprint of this probability distribution.
Yeah.
And that any given, since the probability distribution is the same for any momentum, there's a large number of modes without momentum scale, and so that then there's a spatial distribution
so
that mimics the probability distribution of the wave function. So it's there's some reality to that.
With the stochastic distribution is something you know, and your observation should be uncertain.
It happens that the probability distribution is set up by the wave function is also directly related to the probability distribution of high momentum modes on the sky.
That I think is what's called self-averaging. Or
yeah.
Just the classical probability.
That's right. That's right.
The spatial average is in the.
That's right. That's right, or time average, depending on the problem. So
what is the coherence story will tell us about the tunnel equation?
Well,
what's your
take on that? I only meant to raise it. It raises as an issue. I mean, the problem is when I first start thinking about eternal inflation, I immediately run up against the other problem I mentioned, which is this complementarity issue, and I don't know how to go forward. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, I mean, since whether this thing inflates or. I mean, for example, this calculation of decoherence involved this assumption that I have this classical background and I can ask what is the state of quantum what is the sort of natural ground state of quantum fields on that classical background. And that already assumes that the background is in some sense classical. Before that, I don't entirely know what to do. It's conceivable that all these arguments are okay, but I think you have to state everything a lot more carefully. But the reason I was reluctant to go into more of it, I can never get beyond this more basic point that I don't know what happens at all.
Isn't the black hole complementarity also consistent with the notion of entanglement? I mean, what you observe in your causal patch can be thought of as tracing over the degrees of freedom outside, so
that
there isn't really.
No, I think real black hole complementarity, in the sense I understand it, is that you do not think of the region inside of the black holes being described by, you don't think of these two regions as both being described by an overall local effective field theory. I can talk about states inside the black hole and states outside the black hole. That anything that goes on inside the black hole should essentially be encoded in some complicated, almost thermal way by the Hawking radiation on the outside.
There's nothing to trace out. In the black hole.
Yeah.
The black hole disappeared.
You're talking about the evaporation.
So the entanglement picture has to break down if the black hole disappears or decays to a low entropy.
Right. So that's why I'm. Yeah.
Unless information is lost.
Right.
That's why I'm.
That's one of the reasons I'm hedging about cosmological horizons, that there's no evaporation in the usual sense, as I understand it. That's one of the reasons I'm hedging with cosmological horizons, is that there's no evaporation, which sort of was the thing that really made you make this very strong statement. But taking it, if I make the analogy very strict, then this is a serious issue for terminal inflation.
Yeah, I think he's been very patient, but I think to thank him.